I'm Sieben Norman of the Transatlantic Institute. In part two of our symposium, we turn to the question of terrorism. How can democratic governments counter asymmetric threats? Can derogation of freedoms and liberties ever be justified? And what of potentially illegal actions by the state? How great is the risk, and what measures should liberal-minded people accept in return for the promise of relative safety? The threat to modern civilization, with its vulnerable infrastructure and the proliferation of WMD, is very great indeed. Others, including many on the progressive left, see the exaggeration of the threat as a gift to the authoritarian state. Isabel Hilton, journalist and commentator.
Well, the costs of terrorism are actually quite low, even in terms of lives. 9/11 was terrible, 2,752 lives. But on the same day, more people died on America's roads, and we don't ban the car. If we want to save lives, we should ban the car.
An amusing juxtaposition. Of course, the cost of terrorism goes beyond the calculation of lives, and some believe it threatens the very foundations of our democracies. Isabel Hilton again.
9/11 was terrible, but it was not a threat to the state, nor was 7/7. Any damage done to the principles of the democratic state was done subsequently by the governments of those democracies themselves.
But many progressives are concerned about the usage of the term war on terror, and see this as a longer game, most appropriately dealt with by intelligence services, and are very uncomfortable about military responses. It was generally agreed that intelligence and better infiltration of networks is needed. Oliver Kam, Times columnist and author of Anti-Totalitarianism, the left-wing case for neoconservative foreign policy.
Clearly, Isabel was quite right to say the IRA was hopelessly infiltrated by the time it sued for peace. It was a fairly successful, from what all of us can see, and none of us, I assume, certainly not I, is privy to any specialist or inside knowledge on this. It seemed to be a fairly successful dirty war infiltrating terrorist organisations. It is a very important thing that a democratic state can infiltrate organisations and turn individual supporters of those organisations. One thing we know from the activities of the CIA or the non-activities of the CIA with regard to Islamist terrorist organisations is that they've been completely hopeless at it. And they've been hopeless at it both in the sense of not getting their own people in there and not even trying to turn individual supporters of Islamist organisations. There was a case some years ago of the so-called Lakanala 6, Yemeni Americans who had undergone training in Islamist camps, I think they would have been Bin Laden camps, and who walked away and who received stiff prison sentences for their activities. Would it not have been possible to try covertly to turn them, to get them to join the global jihad and to undermine it from there? There are possibilities for intelligence work that I believe are probably not being tapped and that need to be tapped.
Roundtable participants turned to a discussion of the effectiveness of terrorism. David Clark, former advisor to Robin Cook.
I'm drawn to the point that Alan Dershowitz has made, which is that terrorism exists because terrorism works. In actual fact, there's very little evidence at a strategic level that terrorism succeeds. I can't actually think of a good example of where terrorism has succeeded in achieving its strategic objective. It has and can succeed in achieving tactical objectives. For example, if the PLO's objective in the 1960s and 70s had been to get Arafat the right to stand at the rostrum of the UN General Assembly with a pistol in his hand, then you could say that the PLO was a very effective organisation, but it wasn't. Its objective, of course, was to achieve a Palestinian state, just as the IRA's objective was to achieve a united Ireland, and they didn't succeed in either case.
There needs to be a change in the perception of how grievances can and should be aired, and the pool of those who are willing to die for these causes needs to be reduced. The polarization of the arguments is certainly unhelpful. David Clark again.
I really don't like the idea that we are caught between an ultra-left that sees the West as being able to do no right and a Blairite sort of mindset which believes that the West has and can do no wrong.
But is Northern Ireland really a model to follow in the fight against global jihad? John Bew of the Henry Jackson Society and Peterhouse, Cambridge.
There are myths, and you've heard it from Bill Clinton, from Mo Mullum, from Mandelson, a lot of people across. There's a myth that the Northern Ireland peace process is the model to be sold. Now, actually what happened in Northern Ireland is not that we engaged that politically with Sinn Féin. That was a side issue in the process. In Northern Ireland in 1998, you had a moderate consensus between moderate parties in which Sinn Féin IRA was actually pretty much excluded. They weren't really involved in negotiating the agreement to a great extent, and I'm talking about the institutions, the democratic basis for the agreement. They were on the side. Now, since 1998, and within a couple of weeks, they managed to sell themselves as the party of the Good Friday Agreement. Actually, they were a party that was essentially defeated in its political aims, defeated militarily. And since then, they're on the bandwagon of the Good Friday Agreement. The IRA were beaten, and what happened in 1998 was a moderate consensus between moderate people in Northern Ireland. And I think my key point is, and this extends to the Middle East, is when we talk about the two ideas, defeating the underbelly of grievance and, you know, a serious, how do we defeat terrorism, the terrorists can't be allowed to speak for the problem, to define the underbelly problem.
By looking primarily to policing and intelligence to fight the threat, and the model used to defeat the IRA, do we fail to understand the cultural dimension and genuine roots of jihadism? Alan Johnson, editor of Democratia.
It's not that the two frameworks that were set out are wrong. It's a blowback against injustice. Policing and security framework, they're obviously both right and have important elements that any program would have to take into account. I just think neither of them actually strike me as the most important framework at the moment for us to get our heads around, which is that I think there's a danger of trying to project our rationalism onto what are in effect pathological mass movements.
It's not a mass movement.
Well, in a certain sense, I'll say what I have to say and you can come back. We don't say that in the Second World War we fought Blitzkrieg, and in some ways the question's posed in maybe an inadequate way. We fought Nazism. Similarly today, I think it's important for us to say we're not, in effect, fighting terrorism. I would say, it wouldn't be a consensus in the room, that we're fighting totalitarian political Islam. And it's a pathological mass movement. In some senses, it's a death cult. It's a form of movement that we find great difficulty coming to terms with our understanding, and we tend to project onto it understandings that it looks similar to political rational movements we've dealt with in the past. It's a totalitarian reaction. It's got its roots in the most profound, deep crisis right across the Arab and Muslim world, which has been set out in all of the UN human development reports about that region in great detail, volume after volume. There's been a red wave crashing across that region for decades, which has involved hundreds of thousands of deaths. As Paul Berman puts it, that red wave has crashed across that region. What we've experienced is the flex of that wave thrown up on 9/11. So it's not that more people died that day on the roads and so on in America. It's that understanding I think we need, that this is a regionally rooted crisis which has thrown up a pathological mass movement, a terrorist movement, a totalitarian movement, and the flex of that are being experienced in 9/11 and 7/7 and so on. So I would say that there's no policing solution to that.
A careful look at the phenomenon suggests that the problems are of a very different nature from those presented by previous terrorist movements, and that only through an understanding and appreciation of those differences can we hope to defeat what roundtable discussants termed jihadism. Is it a battle of ideas in which the promotion of democracy is key? For those who see this as a cultural war, the export of democracy is considered a significant weapon in the fight against global jihad and exported terrorism. What is clear is that it is a very different phenomenon from those we've encountered in the past, and the scope for comparison is limited.